Happy birthday, PLR. It's Chaz, and we're very excited to talk to Rick Allison. Part of the PLR magic is the long runs that some of its personalities have had, like Wiggy, Lappy. Our show, Chaz and AJ in the Morning, just hit 18 years in 2021. Rick Allison began his PLR journey in 1975, and if you tune the station in, you will still hear his voice. He described his PLR career as a wonky piece of Swiss cheese, expansive but full of holes. He's done part-time, mornings, program director, the voice of the station, local bands, and has been fired several times. So I'm looking forward to hearing these stories. Today on the PLR Pastcast, Rick Allison. And then you get hired at WPLR in 1975 to do part-time.
Actually, first gig after YBC was at KC101 on Mad Mare Mountain at the transmitter site. I was doing Sunday into Monday, running, tapes and watching deer and turtles and all sorts of stuff up there at the transmitter site.
Why from the why there? Why not at the studio?
It didn't exist.
Oh,
remember we're talking way back when FM was, sort of an afterthought, right? And so, KC101 didn't really exist. It was WKCI, and they were playing, I don't know what package they had, but it was on those mammoth reel-to-reel machines.
Yeah.
That and my only job was to make sure they kept running and occasionally change a tape. But that was my first real paid professional gig, not counting YBC. And then I came to PLR, and I was sort of a part timer and a news part timer. Tim Clark was the news director at the time. I had two stories that I was on during that time. The first was what seemed to be the end of Louis's lunch, because the medical industrial complex was taking over the place of the location of the original Louis's, and it was like, oh no, this the home of the hamburger was going to die. And so Louis Lassen, who ran the joint, was pretty good at promotion, and it became one of our big causes at PLR to help Louis, make the transition to what is now their location. So that was story number one. Story number two was a trainee/officer in the New Haven Police Department who, in trying to stand up for a brother cop, admitted that he'd smoked marijuana and was summarily fired. And that was a story right up PLR's alley, too. That cop was a guy named Paul Kaplow. And Paul Kaplow, in all of our conversations, said, I got this kid brother, he spends afternoons up in his room just, talking into a lamp like he was a radio guy or something. Is there something we can do with him? And so it was suggested he come, and I think he was the first listener liner, maybe Kaplow was.
He, it sounded that way when I talked to him for this past cast. Holy shit. And Louis Lunch, they actually moved that building, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Those are the original bricks.
Damn.
So that was my deal. And then, simultaneously I was doing overnights and fill-ins and stuff like that. And the guy doing mornings was a fellow named Bob Dark. Alfredo Santos.
So what was the lineup there in 1975? So it's Bob Dark in the morning.
Yeah, boy, this is going to be difficult because I think it was Bob Dark. I think it was Weingarth. Bob Neri was involved.
So he was probably Joe doing nights.
Joe from Chicago had already gotten there. Joe was there. And I don't know who was doing overnights at the time. It all gets a little hazy, Chaz.
Yeah, I tell you.
Before that, but it's kind of like assembling, a team of any kind, football team, baseball team. There were these shifting, these shifting lineups, because before all of that, it was Jay Crawford and Tim Clark you know, I mean, just a whole bunch of people who have sort of come and gone from the station. But Bob Dark, you know, I would hang around after I finished my shift and just watch Dark prepare for his morning show. And it was just, I just remember being in the production room at 1294 Chapel Street, and just my sense was this just cloud of quarter-inch tape spewing in every direction as he put together these really fantastical constructions for the morning show. And it was, you know, it was wonderful to learn that way at, you know, at his knee. Then he got, you know, pissed off at the station and left, and I ended up with a morning show.
Now, do you remember why, what he was mad about?
You know, who knows?
Just
it, you know, it's hard to tell. I do remember. I mean, you know, Dark has an interesting history, and I hope at some point you talk to Dick Cult, because Dick Cult is the thread through this, the first decade of PLR. And without the first decade, there's no Chaz and AJ. There's no Smith and Barber. There's no John Griffin. There's no Rick Allison. There's no nothing. That first decade was absolutely seminal and wonderful. And Dick Cult, you know, is the key to the promotional side of things. And the great thing about PLR in that first decade was you had maniacs playing great music and doing wonderful things on the air, but you had some real sharks on the business and promotion side. And Dick Cult was at the center of all that. So I hope you talk to him at some point.
He is on the list. I hope he's willing to do it.
Oh, yeah, he will. I'll tell you, one of the things that's happened during this this year of COVID is that a bunch of PLR OGs have been Zooming on a regular basis. And Dick is one of them. Bob Herpy, the guy who gave us all jobs. A bunch of the jocks. You know, Eddie and Marsha, Gordon, folks from my second era, Mike Curvin, for instance, Neil Brasseferro, you know, Badness, Bruce Mankey, just a ton of people, and Rose Polidoro and Leslie Schaefer and Paula all set it up. It's just been really wonderful, and it's led to a couple of interesting things. Number one, when the word went out from Drew and from Alan that it was the 50th year and they could use help assembling stuff, this group of people has been very helpful in that. And then sprung up about halfway through the idea of doing a documentary on that first decade of PLR. And that's still very much in the works.
Man, that would be, it'd be fantastic.
There are difficulties. There are, as you know, things cost money. So that's, you know, that's the current wall we're walking into. Number one. And number two, I mean, you know, when people think about that first decade, the name that is at the very top is Stoneman.
Yeah.
But, you know, we weren't busy taking pictures of ourselves back then.
Right.
We, you know, there's not a lot of that. So we haven't figured out how that's, we've got some really good cinematographers working on it. So, but that's, you know, that's a save the date for later. It might not be in the 50th year. It might be the 51st when that happens, if it happens.
Do you have a Stoneman story that you'd like to share?
I don't, because, you know, Stoney and I never worked at the station at the same time.
Wow.
When I came to PLR, he'd just been fired. Was that the calling out of the Cheshire Police? It might have been. I was there for a while in my first stint, left in 76.
Wait, what was that with the Cheshire Police?
Well, the story goes, and you know, this is unfixed in time. It happened, but I'm not exactly sure when, and
right.
I don't know if this was the thing that got him fired that time. But he'd heard that there was going to be a bust going down in Cheshire. And he decided to use his bully pulpit to let people know to be careful, because there were some undercover cops, and it was going to be a problem. Again, for details on that, I know you've already talked to Doc Rock, but for details, Doc would be the guy who would have the big details on that. Because, you know, Doc was there from before day one.
Right. Lots of
folks. I know you talked to him. That was a great chat, by the way. He, you know,
He's great.
I'm sort of running this thing that's sort of like a radio old folks home in a certain way. It's called Cygnus Radio. And Doc does a show for us every Wednesday. We've also got a guy who worked in the mid-80s, a guy named Travis. He's on. My old news partner, Lamar, is on. And I've had Mankey and Marsha and Gordon and Eddie and John Seville, and there are others that I've had on my show. So it's a connection with sort of old school PLR, if you will.
That is cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, Doc was telling me about it.
Great fun.
So you're there, 1975, Bob Dark leaves. You end up with the morning show.
How totally long? Unprepared.
Well...
Totally, totally unprepared. Listen, I am absolutely willing to stipulate that I had no idea, you know, this goodie that had been plopped in my lap. And I only realized what a goodie it was when it got unplopped, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting story. There was going to be a change in program directors. This guy named Ronnie Berger hired me. Hired a few other people. He was there for a brief period of time. Jazz musician, nice guy. And he had come from HCN. And remember now, HCN predates PLR by a couple of years, a few years. And when I got to Connecticut in 1969, that was the station to listen to. It was everything. It was the music I wanted to listen to in a way I wanted to hear it. It was a bulletin board about what was happening for, you know, people my age at that time. And people like Gordon Weingarth and Country Paul Payton were on. And these are people that I idolized. You know, so that was really my initial Connecticut radio experience. What PLR got right was some of the HCN music sensibility, but a much more on-point business and promotion sensibility. And it also happened in this fertile period of time when baby boomers were coming into their first gigs after college, had money to spare. It was at an amazingly fertile time musically. You had, you know, these little bitty companies growing up like Subway and Bob Stores and, you know, the Rubber Match and the Sound Store and
right.
All of these, this explosion of lifestyle that just sort of, it was total synergy. And, you know, Jimmy Coplick is there doing his first shows. You know, it was a magical time. There were a lot of things we could have got wrong. There's no question about it. But as it turns out, we got enough of them right in a time when the earth was ready to, you know, harbor this wonderful thing we were growing. Not that thing you're thinking about, I mean, but everything else. Well, that thing too.
How long were you on in mornings before they said this isn't working out?
This wasn't working out. Less half a year, maybe. I was there long enough to introduce Chick Corea and Return to Forever at Todd Nossel. And I think it was after, it might have been the first Pinecrest picnic.
Oh, wow.
That I got news that I was being replaced. I got that news from the guy who was replacing me.
Ouch.
Bob Neri. And, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, at that point, and, you know, you've been a radio guy for the better part of your life, and you've lost jobs. And that first job is always tough to lose because I was a radio guy one minute, and then what was I?
Right.
There was no radio station. That was the one and only time getting fired really got to me at an emotional level. I mean, I got over it, but you know, that really hurt. And it was kind of my fault. we'd heard that the replacement for Ronnie Berger was coming in, and his name was Barry Grant. And I'm not going to say it was my idea, because it wasn't, but Joe from Chicago said, you know, why don't we get Jay Crawford back? He was the program director, you know, before Ronnie, and he was real good. And so Joe and I and a bunch of the rest of the staff decided we'd go over to Bob Herpe's house and ask him if maybe he could change his mind. It was kind of like a sit-in. A couple of weeks thereafter, I was out of a job.
Oh, wow.
You know, what were we fucking thinking? But like I said, I was unprepared.
Yeah. Shit. Then you find out at a Pinecrest picnic?
Yeah, it was a great.
Was Bob doing you a favor by telling you? Did he not know you didn't know? How did that happen?
Oh, he didn't know that I knew.
No.
But you know. I'll tell you something about Bob Murray. He's one of the quality cats on the planet,
yeah,
period.
Agreed.
I was in the ether for a little bit. I picked up a part-time gig at CCC, signed the log on for Litch and stuff, because he was just getting started, and then made the transition to HCN, and was there for a couple of years during the advent of Abram Superstars, which was wrenching. It was, I got into radio not to be an announcer or a personality. I got into radio because I heard you got free records and got to go to concerts for free and rolling papers and Subway coupons. But, I mean, you know, when Abrams came through, the idea was, you know, to cut this. It must have been a 17,000 copy record collection down to 900 albums. Now, by modern radio standards, 900 albums is a lot.
It's a big playlist. Now,
you know, you guys are working on a much smaller playlist. But in those days, to actually physically watch the records be carried out of the air studio and the production studio, or the live music studio, it was hurtful. But I got a sense of what format radio was all about.
Yeah.
And then I got drafted out of there to put the first rock and roll AOR station in Hawaii together.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah, up to the day I left, it was going to be great. The day before I left, I got a call saying, "Hope you're still on." "Yeah, I'm on." "Because there's just been one change." I said, "Really? What's the change?" "It's 1978. Well, WKTU in New York just had a 13 share. They're doing disco. So the owner says, we're going to do disco instead of rock and roll. You still with us?" And that pause was extended over a much longer period of time, but, you know, we're trying to save time here.
Yeah, they were like, "Hello, Rick, did we lose you, Rick?"
The thing is, though, when many of your possessions are already on their way to L.A. and then on to Hawaii, and you put Hawaii on one side of the scale, even something like disco was not enough to displace it. I was intervening time, I was offered a morning gig in Pittsburgh. But even that wasn't enough to throw the scales away from Hawaii.
Wow.
So it was basically, you know, a fully paid year's vacation in Hawaii doing radio on a radio station that didn't even exist when I arrived on the island. But that's a whole other story.
Did you love it? What was Hawaii like?
Oh, Hawaii was great. My wife, a social worker, attempted to get a job there. And the only thing she was offered over the time we were there, which was a year, was job in the maximum security prison. We decided to opt out.
Good choice.
And she also is an Olympic class bargain shopper. And there's no way to do that on Hawaii, because other than pineapples and some really good herb, everything else has got to be shipped in.
Right.
There are not a lot of bargains. It's hard. It's a very expensive place to live. Not belly aching, because we were paid pretty well. And I was living on a beach called Lanikai, which is
Sounds fabulous.
Just a gorgeous, gorgeous place. But the station was brokered. The guy that changed it from rock to disco decided he wanted to be the Ted Turner of San Francisco, so he sold it. And a lot of my other colleagues who were there had already bailed. They got what's called rock fever. Easy to get if you're not inclined to dive in a whole body kind of way to the lifestyle of Hawaii. It was a wonderful place.
And then before you came back to PLR in 1980, you did some time in New York?
Yeah, at PIX. That was the station that Joe from Chicago and Meg Griffin were running. And I was reunited with Alfredo Santos, Bob Dark.
Oh, shit. That must have been great.
It was the best format I've ever worked at.
So what were you guys taking on? Were you guys taking on NEW?
Yeah, from the punk side of things.
Oh, nice.
Because our view was that NEW was sort of staid and, they were legends. You know, you got a guy like Muni and whatnot. I mean, but it was difficult for them to adapt, right? And so we were assaulting from the below 14th Street side of things. We had great listeners. My first, let's call it local band show, was at PIX. It was called the No Major Record Show. And some of the unsigned artists that I played included the Smithereens and Marshall Crenshaw.
Holy shit.
And the DBs. And it was a show I inherited from Jim Ladd. No, that's not right. Jim Kerr, excuse me.
Jim Kerr, holy shit.
Yep. I mean, prior to that, at PLR, for instance, local bands were a part of our regular rotation. I mean, that was just, you know.
That's how it was done.
That was how it was done. That's correct.
So
that's always been a passion.
How long were you?
And it was also another really exciting termination, including at the final bit. My last shift was done without me being able to talk. They said, you can do one more shift, but you can't speak. Mm. But we were in a punk rock radio station, so I didn't need me and my words to tell people how I felt. That was a piece of cake. Radio was in the hands of such a lot of fools trying to anesthetize the way that you feel. And the sad thing was, you know, our replacement was Bette Midler in Love Songs, nothing but love songs. And our promo pictures were all put down at the guards. This is in the Daily News building on 42nd Street, at the guard station on the first floor. Under no circumstances should these people be allowed back up in the station. We lost a lot of good music that way, unfortunately.
Boy, but what a fantastic, there's another movie, Rick. There's another movie from your life right there. That's that time period right there. Is that your
awesome.
Is that your favorite time in radio?
I've had a bunch, Jess.
Yeah.
I gotta tell you, for instance, and then we, you know, we segue into, I spent a little time on what was called PLR2, the Big Beat.
The AM station?
Yes, 1220.
Yes.
That's which you know, started out as woman rate, well.
Right, I mean, WONN. Right.
Yeah. And we were doing some really bizarre shit there. That was kind of, I mean, Joe was working there also. My friend from Hawaii, Rabbit, was working there. And we did some out there stuff, but, you know, no one could hear it.
Right.
You know, that was the problem with that station. It was a daytime, 1,000-watt daytime AM station, which meant this time of year, you couldn't hear it on the Q Bridge. You know, I mean, it was really tough to build an audience. But then, you know, PLR, you know, the golden age, the Barry Grant era, which had assembled people like Marcia and Eddie and Stoney and Griffin and, you know, Calabrese and all these wonderful jocks, you know, ran into some job difficulties right around 1980. I think they tried to organize.
Yeah, I heard this story.
And I won't go into it any more detail than that, but they all lost their gigs, and something had to happen. And it was a very interesting time, 1980, on a lot of counts. Number one, all these absolutely beloved characters. I mean, listen, you've been on the air for, 18 years now? I mean, doing the mornings for 18 years, longer than that at PLR.
Right.
But, Marsh's name, Eddie's name, Stoney's name, Wiggy's name.
Gordon.
These are you mention them to anybody of a particular age in this area. And yeah, they're beloved. And all of a sudden, poof.
Gone.
And so here come, me and a bunch of upstarts, Joni McCarthy, Michael Curvin, Joe from Chicago, George Scheibner, Calabrese was there. And so we meet resistance because of that. And music has changed because 1980, what is that? It's the birth of MTV. How are we going to, do we acknowledge MTV? Do we compete against MTV? Do we embrace MTV? Video killed the radio star? Really? We're not going to let that happen. Radio is going to co-opt the video star. That was our position. But at the same time, what did that mean? That meant that you think about that first flock of MTV stars, and it's the Buggles and, it's Elvis Costello and it's people making videos, and a lot of them are Brits, but it's not Marshall Tucker. It's not Allman Brothers. It's not, Rory Gallagher. It's not the sort of blues-based stuff that had been absolute, fodder at PLR, on top of all the other music they played. I'm not trying to characterize them as stuck in that way, but that was certainly Barry's thing. He was definitely a blues-based cat. And so at the same time in 1980, when all the familiar voices had been sacked and all these unfamiliar voices had come back in, the music changed at the same time. The management changed at the same time. And, it was a rough go.
I remember waking up one day and everything was different.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So from the listener, and it was very difficult.
The thing you have in your favor as a radio guy is what's called in wrestling riding time. It's like being there. The years you put in mornings have made you become a fixture in the morning. It's a cycle, and it's a cycle that's impossible to break from the outside, So you build an understanding of who you are and a need for people to hear you on a regular basis. And we were there at a time when everything changed. It was wild.
That is a difficult position to be in. What shift did you do then?
Mornings.
So you're back in mornings now.
Oh, yeah. I did mornings. I did it first with Dennis Lamar, who was the news department. And then Carla Rodebush came in. Carla fired my friend Dennis and started doing mornings with me at PLR. I think my favorite part of that whole time, other than the music, I loved, in spite of what I said about the wrenching change, remember, I came from PIX and to a certain extent from HCN, which was AOR, and even a little disco slice in there. So, I was not against music you could dance to. And that was kind of a theme of that, that period of time. And we had great jocks. I mean, Joni McCarthy was awesome. And Michael Curvin, just absolutely tremendous. And Joe, I mean, he's world class. We had a great staff. It was just a bumpy time.
I remember about Joe is, as a listener, that he was off a lot. Like, I don't know if he was sick a lot or if he was in management and had to do other things. Him and Eddie Haskell, does that ring a bell to you or no?
Not really.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I can tell you, and Kaplo will tell you this probably has, Joe was late a lot.
Well, maybe that's what it was.
And it pissed Kaplo off because Kaplo was running Rent a DJ at the time. He had gigs to get to.
Right.
So, okay. So if Joe was going to be late, that, But there's a way to solve that problem. It's the same way the Stone Man, you know, origin story occurred. You put a long record on and see what happens.
Right. So how long did you do mornings in that run?
2.5 years, I guess. I retired as, you know, here's the thing. I was also program director in the last year and a half or so.
Who and did you know. Did you come in at, like, that was Campmeyer who left? Or?
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Just a natural reaction.
You know, that I no one typically has a great reaction to that name. But
he burned a lot of bridges. You know, he listen. I owe him on a couple of levels in terms of being given the reins of the station. I don't know if he was doing that to protect himself against the waves of angry listeners. I'm not sure, but and he invented the Electric Brunch, which was, you know, that another one of my favorite things in radio ever.
And I can't think of that show without thinking of you.
Well, I was the only one who ever did it.
Well, that's probably why then.
and, you know, I mean, it was a regular on the air feature, but on Fridays, every Friday, Dr. Dan, who was our absolutely brilliant engineer, and you know Dr. Dan, he was certainly there when you were there, right?
A little fuzzy on that one.
Okay. Anyhow, total genius. He was the kind of guy who you had to be careful because he'd start explaining something to you, and it's like a zip file. You know, if you take it in, it starts to unpack in your brain and your head can explode. He was that kind of guy. Anyhow, he set up a booth at the Elm City Diner. It's an Indian joint these days called Tandoor, but it was a block away from 1294 Chapel Street. And so we did a live show every Friday with just listeners in some cases. Some cases, you know, people at the station. The go-go's, the waitresses, the busboys, Felix Cavallari, Vinny the limo driver, Jimmy Koplik, Big Mike, all these people, you know, had shows. I've just, this 50th year anniversary has caused me to, like, dive down an amazing rat hole of memory, most of which is not internally stored in my brain. I mean, there's stuff that, are you aware of this guy, Timothy Wood?
No.
That name ring a bell?
No.
If you go to the WPLR early days page, you'll see collateral posters, events, stuff like that, that he posts on the WPLR early days page. He's a listener. He grew up in Waterbury. He loves everything PLR, and he loves everything rock and roll. And he also has absolutely superhuman research ability.
Wow.
He can find this shit. He, for instance, found the fact that the waitresses were my guests at the Electric Brunch. I totally spaced that out. I just posted it the other day. And this is before Christmas wrapping became a Christmas tradition. But he reminds me of things that I have no memory of. I know I was there because there are pictures.
I know a guy like that. His name is Phil. He's our producer. He remembers everything. Oh, yeah, wow. I'll have to look this guy up.
Yeah. Well, go to, you know, just check him out. So anyhow, that ended. I resigned as PD. I said, you'll have to fire me as disc jockey. That happened.
Now, why did
same time?
Why did you resign as PD?
Because the station, you know, was not performing to management's requirements. I took responsibility.
Oh.
That was it.
Not a lot of people do that.
I mean, well, you know, so anyhow, it was the best thing that ever happened. I'd had a kid in 1983. Her name was Caitlin. And, so I was out of a job, and this another wonderful creature, Donna Goodman, who was a salesperson at PLR.
God bless her.
He said, let me hook you up with my my friend Kenny. Kenny does the advertising for pub stores. I said, oh, okay, cool. Because up to that point, I'd been the voice of Bob's at PLR, and I got free boots and free jeans, and it was never a gig. Well, in 1983, I took over, 1984 probably, I took over all of Bob's advertising and became the Bob's guy. And that was my introduction to voiceovers, which is really what made my life most wonderful. So I set up a little studio in the on the second floor of our little beach house we rented in East Haven, and spent all of Caitlin's life with her. Actually, she only lived for 2 years.
Oh man!
I got 100% of those 2 years. Oh, she's absolutely alive in my life every day. So a blessing, a curse, a blessing.
Right.
I started doing voiceovers as a result of being on TV and the radio everywhere all the time. And that's what sort of made me a voiceover announcer.
And not sort of. One of the most sought after voiceover talents, and I spoke to Kaplow last week, and that podcast will go up on the website shortly. But we talked about you guys going into New York.
And, amazing.
And the New York Times article calling you guys the Twin Towers because you were both very tall, but both very tall in the industry and stature as well.
We were just babies when that article came out. And there's, by the way, there's a PLR connection to that article. One of the news guys at PLR, a guy named Pat Hennessy, was married to the author of that piece. His wife wrote that piece. And I think Patrick... she probably was saying something like, Pat, I don't know what to write about. Her name is Jackie Fitzpatrick. So she interviewed us and then went on to interview a bunch of other folks. But I'll tell you what. I mean, Kaplow and I spent a lot of time together. It would have been a whole different experience to have experienced the voiceover life in New York alone. But he and I commuted in, pretty much every day for a real long time. And here's the thing, unlike radio, because in order to do it in New York, you have to be in SAG and AFTRA, you get a pension, you earn a pension. It's old school. I mean, before Ronnie Reagan, unions offered pensions, jobs had pensions. This is something that radio missed entirely, because not only did radio pay piss poor, in my first stint, I was happy to be at a place where every Tuesday the record guys came to give us vinyl. I mean, for me, who needs money? Are you kidding me? And I get to go see Santana too tonight? What? What? So, and Subway coupons. I mean, come on, you can live on those. So we didn't know anything about money. Radio did not pay that well, and it certainly did not offer anything in the way of pension or any kind of long-term stuff. But frankly, at that point in our lives, we weren't thinking long-term.
Right.
These are adult realities that we had not yet contended with. I know that right now, radio is in this sort of contracting kind of place. And fortunately for you and AJ, you guys are the glowing heart of radio, of PLR. I mean, no Chaz and AJ, no PLR. I mean, that's the way I view it anyhow. And I think you guys are being compensated properly. But that was not always the case.
No.
Matter of fact, the reason that Smith and Barber left and went down to Florida, remember that?
Yeah.
That's because they weren't being paid. And they played hardball. And PLR played hardball back at him. And Smith and Barber said, later for you. And then PLR said, but wait. And they said, sorry, already made the deal. And so that period of time, I also worked during that period of time doing morning. That period of time when Griffin was trying to train a couple of comedians to be radio guys.
Now, yeah, let's set this up here. So Griffin is also Wiggy. And so Smith and Barber are kicking ass, beating everything in sight in the mornings on PLR. They were,
but remember, Smith started as an intern at PLR, and so he was like homegrown. It was kind of like Yankees and a farm team player.
Yeah.
So if you grow somebody from the inside, you know, you sort of, you know, you increase their pay a little bit, but it's not like the going rate out there in the real world.
Right.
And so they were bringing amazing bushels of shekels to PLR, and they realized it. And they said, wait a minute.
And Bruce told me this story, and he told it on the air as well, so I'm not talking out of school here. Him and Brian got on separate calls. They conferenced him with the guy in Florida. They had numbers in mind, and they thought, well, let's just start with double what we're making now, and we'll see what they say. The guy in Florida gets on the phone with Smith and Barber, and they say the number, and the guy says, okay. Doesn't even think.
you know you've made a mistake.
Yes.
You know you've undershot.
Right. So they leave, and the state was in shock, really. And right. Wiggy.
It was as big a deal as losing Marsha and, you know, and Stone. It was that big a deal.
Right up there. Yep. So Wiggy asks you to do mornings while they figure out what to do.
And meanwhile, trying to train two comedians. Now, the right solution would have been to have a radio guy and a comedian. I mean, you got a stunt monkey, you know?
Yeah.
But you got to have someone who knows how to hit the post.
Right.
And if you're both going for the punchline and you're trying to out-punchline each other, you know, you're going to end up talking over the vocals.
Right. It was a real treat for me to be doing the overnights when you'd come in and I just saw you how you would – do mornings, and I would just sit in a production room and look through the window, acting like I had work to do, but I was actually just wanted to see a radio pro in action. So it was really interesting to see. And that morning show hummed with great music when you were doing it. It was really like a throwback to me, like, wow, this is what PLR used to be like.
I got to say one thing. This is something, you know, I was in thinking about this chat we're having here. I wanted to say this one thing. Right now, in radio's current condition, there is no farm team. I mean, Smith was able to farm team with Nude Night and all that stuff
right.
in the overnights, do all sorts of stuff that would never fly during the daytime, but, you know, he could get away with and try stuff out. Same way Camp Chaos happened.
Right.
You just ran amok. And, you know, and as a matter of fact, you were useful for Griffin because Griffin could always threaten Smith and Barber with you. but, you know, I mean, we don't have the farm team possibilities for, you know, the next Chaz and AJ have really diminished. I mean, unless you consider, you know, online podcast, that kind of stuff, which is really a whole other issue.
So you filled in for the morning show. Were you doing local bands then? When did they ask you to do local bands?
Well, they didn't ask. I asked them. It was in 1988. The woman that was running my studio, Amy Creelan, Amy Satterjee,
right,
was in a band. James, my good friend James Velvet, was in a band. Everybody I knew had bands. And I'd already had some experience playing local music on PLR in my first couple of stints and also at PIX, and always felt like, you know, every band is a local band. The Beatles are a local band. They happen to be local to Liverpool. And I know that it goes to the point about, you know, training the next morning guys. You have to have a healthy farm team, and new music comes out of that farm team. And so you got to nurture it. And so I look around, I'm a radio guy. James is a musician who also was very much an encourager of other musicians, put coffee houses and other concerts together. And so we went to our buddy Griffin, who was running things at the time, and said, listen, you know, we wanted a show for the local bands. What do you think? And, you know, those were heady days. And he said, sure, why not? You want an hour? And I said, yeah, I don't know. An hour might be too much. How about a half hour every week? And that was in 1988. We're about to celebrate our 34th birthday. into our 35th year this March.
Eddie Saab and I argue over who played the first local band show.
I know you did. I wish I could tell you, but I can't.
Yeah. No, I know it was me. Eddie is wrong, but
okay,
that's okay.
All right, fine. Yeah. You guys played it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Well, it has to be the longest running local band show in the history of.
Yes. It's also the longest running show, period, on PLR.
Right.
At this point.
Right.
And like I might have mentioned, how do we do this magic? I mail the show in, and I'm not on the payroll.
You have your best luck with PLR when you're not in the building and you're not getting paid by them.
Yes, sir. You know, the abrasive surfaces that may occur with management and with me just don't get to rub up against each other.
Right.
It's very nice. And I listen, just like you, the local band show has gone through how many owners and how many different managements?
Right.
It's astounding. So props to you, pal, for, you know, for doing your little dance, too. You know, I mean, you've done good.
I was telling Capital.
I'll tell you what. During this COVID time, you guys have absolutely, I mean, you were doing great before it. But you guys have absolutely risen to the role of leaders and voices of reason. I mean, you know, that was probably not originally your idea. But, I mean, the kind of things you're doing in terms of outreach and helping people cope with this time is just amazing.
Thank you. I was telling Caplo a great lesson that I learned in radio thanks to Wiggy. One, Wiggy put me on the air, so I owe him so much for that. I shouldn't have been on the air when he put me on, but he gave me a shot. But then he gave me one of the best lessons you can get. I was two ratings books into doing the night show. I took it from sixth to first in the first book and then doubled the numbers in the second book. Not quite Stone Man numbers, but on my way. And I'm thinking my shit doesn't stink. Wiggy brings me in the office one day and is telling me about something he doesn't like that I'm doing. And he says, and I don't want to tune in tonight and hear you talking about this in your vindictive tone. So
I know where this is going.
You were there. You were on the other end of it, right? So he goes to male bonding night, I think over your house or over at Caplo's house.
Caplo's, yeah, around the pool table.
Yeah, and then I come on and I start talking about not being able to talk about it. That, to him, felt like I was fucking with him. So he gets in his car and he drives over and rips me out of the building, and I'm driving down the street now listening to what was my show. Being done as if I never existed. And it was a great lesson to learn how fast you could be replaced. And so
that's exactly the lesson of my first firing. Isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
And then you went to Texas.
Right. So, Wiggy was nice enough to let me back, on, and then in 1994, I got hired to do mornings on the Z-Rock network. It was heard in 34 different markets, six large markets throughout the country. I lasted about a year before I did a bit that, as Disney was buying ABC, I did an un-Disney-like bit. And this was at the time where it was a $30 billion merger. It was the biggest merger in the history of the entertainment world at that point. And it was in front of the FCC, and some mom heard it in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and she sent letters to the FCC, to Michael Eisner, and short end of it is, I'm in Texas with a mortgage and a baby and no job.
And then it was off to Long Island, right?
So I did like 3 months in California. Yeah, I used that as an air check machine. Went to Long Island, met AJ. And the weird thing about radio is it's a shitty business. It's like NASCAR, you know. You're racing, you're trying to win. You see your friend hit the wall, you got to just keep driving. And yep. I'm listening to AJ, never met him, but listening to him do his last show, knowing that it's his last show and knowing that he doesn't know it's his last show. A couple months later, I meet him in a bar, and he was just a complete gentleman. We became friends. They hired him back to do the night show. I become program director. And I realized that guy is so funny in our staff meetings, just okay on the air when he's driving, but he's more of like a back in the back of the bus kind of guy, you know? So I made him my partner, and it was the best move I've made in my career.
For both of you.
Yeah.
Yeah, no question about it, man. And isn't it weird the way things happen?
It really is.
But,
like
you know,
said.
Every one of those moves, every one of those terminations, every one of those leavings builds a better radio person, I think. Gives you more of an idea of the fragility of your position. Because you're just pushing hot air. That's all you're doing, man.
Yeah.
And if you happen to piss somebody off, you can, you know, push hot air in, you know, in your living room, and no one's going to hear you because they take your stick away.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's you've learned well.
It was a great lesson to learn so early in the career, you know.
Yep.
But to grow up listening to PLR, listening to you guys and girls do what you did and do it so well, and then to just walking in the building the first day, seeing everybody that I've been hearing, and then meeting all you guys, and then now being in this position to talk to all of you guys and girls, it's mind-blowing to me to be so blessed to be in this position. I'll always feel like I'm not supposed to be here, like I'm not worthy of what you guys put together, but I'm glad to be here.
Well, here's the deal. I mean, all of history, all of human history, and certainly the history of PLR, is people standing on the shoulders of giants before them. That's absolutely the history. And so you go back to a guy like Bob Herpe, who bought an FM station, thanks to the FCC and the rule they made about ownership. The FM frequency became available. And at that point, FM, believe it or not, was still an experiment in a lot of ways. There were a couple of places, BCN, you know, NEW, a couple stations on the West Coast that were seeming to make a go of it by hiring hippies with record collections. But, you know, that was it. And because it wasn't until the mid-70s that the listenership teeter-totter started to go in the direction of FM. AM was the ruler. Bob Herpe bought it exactly the right time, hired exactly the right people in exactly the right environment, and magic happened.
Man, here's to another 50.
Oh, okay. You're in charge of those, pal.
Rick Allison, thank you, brother.
Hey, a pleasure talking with you. I hope we, at some point or other, get all of the folks who are still drawing a breath together sometime this 50th year.
That would be tremendous.